This is the podcast for Monday, November 21st, 2011, Ethics. So today we're going to be talking about Friedrich Nietzsche. Somebody asked before class, how do you pronounce the name Nietzsche? It's German. I don't know, anybody here taking German, have some couple years of German or something? If you look at the name, how does it look like it would be pronounced?
Nietzsche.
Nietzsche. Nietzsche. Nietzsche. Right. Nietzsche. Right, Nietzsche. So it's not Nietzsche. It's like saying Nietzsche is like saying, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre, the famous French philosopher. When if you want to say it the French way, it's, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre, right? Or if you just want to say Sartre, that's fine, but you don't call him Sartre. So it's Friedrich Nietzsche, and he's... I suppose, what would you say about it? I remember having this discussion with... another philosophy grad student when I was at Syracuse, and I said, you know, it seems to me that Nietzsche, you know, they say he went insane at the end of his life. I think he meant insane like in the middle, like when he was writing all this stuff, because it seems kind of crazy. He said, oh no, Nietzsche is the most sane philosopher I've ever read. And I was thinking, there's something wrong with this guy. So if you're reading this and you're thinking this guy is crazy, you know, you're not alone. A lot of people think that you know, he has some sort of startling and radical things to say, and his style is, you know, overblown, effusive, some would say romantic. You know, Ayn Rand was a fan of Nietzsche, and still I think, even though she rejected a lot of his ideas, she really liked his romantic style. So he always, you know, pushes forth his points with gusto and is sort of cynical and sarcastic and over the top with his rhetoric and makes funny little analogies and likes sticking his thumb in the eyes of his sticking his thumb in the eyes of, I guess, religious people, the intelligentsia, I mean, pretty much everybody. He has bad things to say across the board about, you know, pretty much everybody. Although, I mean, there are certain people that he likes. Some people he likes and he had a falling out with, like Schopenhauer. Yeah.
I was going to say, how is that different from all the other philosophers?
I don't know. I think Hume was sort of friendly and affable in the way he skewered his opponents.
But he still said they're wrong.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make it sound like Nietzsche is sort of a disagreeable fellow who hates everyone. It's just the way in which he puts his disagreement is, I mean, I find him a philosopher, so if I'm going to read a philosopher, and I had a choice between reading, you know, Nietzsche's Behold the Man. Ecce Homo is one of the names that means behold the man in Latin. And if I had a choice between reading that and reading some paper by, like, Bertrand Russell, or some, like, philosophy of language paper from the modern era on rigid designators and language or something, you know, I picked the Nietzsche. Because Nietzsche, and, you know, even Nietzsche versus Kant. You read Kant, you're like, what the heck is he saying? The style is, like, hard to follow. But Nietzsche, at least, he's very poetic. Let's see. What am I going to do? Well, let me just call up this thing of the death of God. So when Nietzsche says God is dead, what does he mean? Good place to start. That God is dead. That's one of the famous things he's known for. You might have seen a bumper sticker. You know, God is dead, Nietzsche. Nietzsche's dead, God. But that's like a famous statement. It appeared on the cover of Time magazine. In this sort of black cover, and is God is, I can't remember if it says God is dead or is God dead, but what does that mean? Yeah,
I think he meant that we've both cast our need for God.
Yeah, that God's sort of on the way out. That nobody really believes in God anymore, and really, you know, what he's saying is faith in God is dead. So it's not that God was once alive and then he you know, died of a long illness or something. It was very sad. No, God's there never has been a God, and it's just that God, you know, had a certain role in society, and now people are waking up to the fact that there is no such being. And so that's what he means by God is dead. So what if you think about like what would be going on in Europe in like the 19th century? In what ways might you say that God was dead in 19th century Europe, or maybe even today? Yeah, Industrial Revolution, modern technology, and so people are thinking, oh, I'm living in the modern world. The Industrial Revolution came on the heels of the Scientific Revolution, the Age of Reason, and Nietzsche thinks if you're going with reason, God's got to go out the window. Roughly speaking, I think Nietzsche's idea is that if not talking about like your average person, like your lower class person doesn't know any better, again from Nietzsche's point of view. But Nietzsche would say if you're an intellectual, if you're a person teaching in a university, if you're a person who reads books on heady subjects, you don't believe in like these fables and stories from the Bible. You don't believe in a big man in the sky who loves you and is going to take you up there, and that you have a ghostly mini-me that lives inside your brain and kind of follows your body around, that when you die it floats up to heaven, which is up there beyond the clouds, and they'll wipe away all your tears and make everything great. He thinks that's something for old superstitious women and little children. No serious, an intelligent, educated person would believe in those sorts of things. And so, in that way, if you contrast that with, say, the Middle Ages, everybody believed in God. And everybody believed in a literal hell where people would have their flesh be burned. And people believed in a literal heaven and a literal Armageddon. And they saw a demon behind every bush. And they believed in witchcraft and all kinds of superstitious stuff. And all of culture and life revolved around the church. And the church had a lot of political power. The church and God was in a person's mind when they woke up in the morning till the time they went to bed at night. There would be church bells ringing. There would be prayer services. And your average person would think about God a lot. In modern Europe, he says, well, if you're like a European, you don't think about God until like maybe you pass a church and you're like, oh yeah, it's great architecture or something, and you think, oh yeah, that's that God stuff, how silly, right? And you keep on walking. And this is, again, from Nietzsche's point of view, that society has gone from the sort of superstitious era where everybody believes in the supernatural now to this era of science and reason where God's not important anymore. And so in this sense, Nietzsche would say God is dead, meaning, faith in God is dead. And, at the time in Western Europe, this was, I don't know if it was totally true, but it was true at least that God was sort of on his way out. And you look at Europe today, and I posted this on the forum, some statistics about how many people believe in God in Europe compared to the U.S. And it's really, countries like France and Germany and Sweden, even though they might be nominally Catholic, and if you go up to like a Frenchman on the street, you ask him what his religion is, and they'll say, I'm Catholic. And what does that mean? Well, it means that when they were born, the priest sprinkled a little bit of water in their head, and they were baptized or whatever. And when's the last time you've been to church? When I was baptized, or maybe they took me for communion when I was 12 because that's just what you do. So even now, actually, you get people that weren't raised with any religion. If you ask them what religion they are, they're like, I don't believe in religion. And so you look at like Germany and France and Belgium and some of most Western European countries, belief in God is getting less and less. You get cases where you have a quarter to a third of the country are atheists or live secular lives. And then you have another third who are maybe, they kind of believe in something, but it's kind of, Eastern-y, they like Buddhism and Hinduism. They believe there's something, but they're not quite sure what it is. But they don't believe in traditional religion. You probably heard a lot of people today say, no, I believe in, God, or key phrase for a person that doesn't have real religious convictions, whatever you want to call it. right? They'll say, oh, God or absolute spirit or something. So whatever you want to call it. I believe there's something afterwards, but I just don't think we can know anything about it. And that's a common view today. And they say, well, I don't believe in organized religion. I'm like, oh, you like your religion disorganized, do you? what they mean is, well, I don't believe in any particular religion. I just think there might be some sort of God or supreme being, but I think that he doesn't have much to do with my day-to-day life, and I guess I'll find out all about it when I die. And that's kind of the line you get from more and more people. I think a late survey I saw not too long ago showed like 15% of the American population describe themselves as being secular, you know, being without religion. Not necessarily atheists, but thinking, well, you know, religion doesn't have much to do with their daily life. They don't really believe in the supernatural. They, as far as like, you know, miracles and you know, that praying does any good or those sorts of things. They don't believe in evil spirits or demons or angels. And so the proportion of even American society has gotten bigger and bigger. In Europe, it's a lot more so. It's, you know, people are a lot more secular. And church attendance in Europe is really, really small. So a lot of churches, just out of disuse, they've been turned into museums. The tourists go there and check them out. But it's not like they hold services there. And so Nietzsche is, you know, I think very prescient in seeing that Europe was headed towards a more secular point of view. Anybody have any observation? I don't know if anybody's been to Europe or known exchange student from Europe and asked them what they thought about religion or about Americans' religiosity.
I had an employee once who was from England, and one of his he had lived over here several years, and his one of his I don't know if it was a surprise, but the way he described it, he couldn't understand why there were so many different denominations and churches, and why everybody who wasn't religious couldn't just join together under one church. That was his something that he was just flabbergasted by, that there were so many different religious organizations.
Because he's used to like Church of England, I guess, right? Which is like basically Henry VIII wanted to divorce one of his wives and the church wouldn't let him. And so he said, fine, I'll form my own damn church. The Episcopal Church used to actually run an ad that had a picture of Henry VIII on it and said, you know, in a church started by a man who had eight wives, forgiveness goes without saying. We're the Episcopal Church. So, yeah. And I think that, you know, the Church of England, you get people who are sort of normal churchgoers, but they don't take their religion too seriously. You know, they kind of show up at Christmas and Easter. They're kind of like lapsed Catholics here in the U.S. They show up a few times a year. You get like the people who are regular attendees. You typically older people from a previous generation where religion had a greater role. And even in America, in the 50s, you know, if somebody wasn't a regular churchgoer, they're sort of an oddball. And even people that didn't really believe in Christianity would show up to their Methodist or Episcopal or Lutheran church, except for maybe people that like had an axe to grind against the church or for whatever reason. The people that are sort of countercultural might not go. But if you're a respectable member of the community, you'd show up to church, all your friends would be there. I remember I had a philosophy professor, and he told me he was a Lutheran. But then as I was talking to him more, I found out like he wasn't even sure there was a God. But what made him a Lutheran was he likes going to this building on Sundays. He likes hearing the old hymns. He loves the organ music. His wife actually played the organ at this church, and all his friends were there. And that's sort of it's sort of like a social club which shared a kind of the Lutheran culture. But he didn't really believe in any of this stuff. He thought that Jesus was some itinerant exorcist and faith healer from the first century, not Son of God, not Savior of mankind, didn't believe in heaven and hell. He had a kind of an Easternized version of God as the ground of being. He loved this theologian, Paul Tillich, who says that God is basically just a symbol and describes him kind of the Eastern terms. And so it was just sort of interesting talking to him. And I would say he was, you know, a person who's more and more typical of the mainline churches. And the mainline churches are dying out because they don't really believe in the stuff anymore. And so there's no impetus for evangelism, right? If you say, I'm going to go out and preach the gospel of a great symbol, it's not going to be something that's going to draw people in. Whereas if you say you can be forgiven of your sins or you can have eternal life in heaven, that's something that might sort of excite people or have meaning in your life. But if you're like sort of a liberal minister and you're saying, oh, well, we may never know what happened on that Easter morning, but boy, you know, it sure gives me hope that something might have happened. It doesn't make any sense. And so the idea that most people have is like, well, okay, my parents maybe go to this old dusty Lutheran church and I got to stand up and sit down and kneel and stand up and repeat these words. And it's kind of boring. And it's like, I'm not going to go back there because it doesn't have anything to offer me. And then either they live their life as a secular person, or maybe they run into like a Calvary Chapel person, or like, you know, run into like a more Pentecostal denomination, which is the religion is very vibrant and living, and where it's sort of this deep emotional thing as opposed to this ritual thing. So anyway, Nietzsche said that belief in God is on its way out, that nobody really believes in God anymore, meaning, you know, serious intellectual people. It's no longer a serious intellectual hypothesis, whereas in the Middle Ages you had Thomas Aquinas, you know, wasn't a dummy, you had all these medieval philosophers, and they were all, you know, philosophizing on the basis of this bad idea that we call God. Okay. Oh, that's what I'm looking for. Any thoughts on the death of God? Let me ask another question. So where do you think things see things going? So this is something that's in the forum discussion this week. So you think, you expect God to die out? Imagine, like, you know, 500 years in the future, where there's spaceships and, you know, interstellar travel and all that stuff. Is you know, God still going to be around? Is there still going to be religion?
Who created the universe?
Well, that's a good question. So you think that as long as that question isn't answered, that
there'll always be a higher power, there'll always be another entity that we can't conscious. You can't do it. Nobody's been able to do it, including anybody you spoke of yet.
What if you have like some quantum physicist that comes out with something, a bunch of equations, and says, "Well, here's
prove it." Where's the wall at out there? Where's it stop?
Yeah.
Science fiction is a great example because there's writers out there who speculated that if we advance our technology so much that we might actually forget more than we're learning, and so we may create eventually new gods, like a machine god, because there's forgotten technology that we no longer know how it works, and they perform obligations or rituals to keep the machine going.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just one example, but it could be that they create deities for things that we don't understand, or keep the populace in the dark about so that they don't break it.
Done this for thousands of years and it's still
going. I suppose, like, you know, Voltaire was basically saying that, you know, that the Bible is dead and gone, and Christianity isn't going to last another generation. It's still around here. You see, is there a refresh or reload button here? Where is it? Where do they hide that thing?
F5.
Oh, these damn F keys.
If you want happening. To totally refresh the previous page,
yeah.
Shift F5.
Right, and N for Nietzsche. P. Oh, there it is. All right.
For a total browser restart.
Control F5. So here's
They just tried to move in.
I should just bring my little, I've got a little dongle where I can plug in my laptop. Maybe I'll have to start doing that. Let's get started figuring out where all the buttons are. So here's Nietzsche. So you can see the sort of piercing eyes and stare. And so that's pretty typical, I think.
It's a creepy little eyebrow. Not about hand sandwiches.
Well, you could give him his mouth.
And what are you talking about? Just so you guys see.
That's a really good. There's another better picture than
this.
Here's Nietzsche as a young man, so he didn't always look so dour. There, his mustache hasn't quite gotten out of control yet. He can still eat, you know, minister soup. Little eyeglasses.
It's whale brain.
Here's him later on. You can see the mustache is practically down to his chin.
Capture Trump.
The wolf. What do you call that? Ed Grimley hairdo. And here's a wider shot of that first one, I think.
That's a philosophizing pose.
Yeah, so there's a typical philosophizing pose, right? So Nietzsche is what's known as a postmodern philosopher. So modern philosophy is characterized by an idea of philosophy as a quest for knowledge, the idea that we can understand the world through the use of reason, that the world sort of makes sense, and truth is discoverable. And Nietzsche, I think, challenges these assumptions in certain ways. So he's interpreted, you know, mostly because of his style, I think because of the fact that he's a German, as a postmodern philosophy. He's writing after the modern period, which is a modern period end. I mean, basically, probably with Hume, you know, with David Hume is when, you know, the modern period ended, and you get this sort of postmodern philosophy in the 19th century of people questioning these basic assumptions about truth and reality, and really even the ability to do traditional philosophy. Nietzsche had a bit background in classical Greek philosophy, and so he makes, you know, scattered allusions to classical works in your reading. I don't worry about this too much if you don't get the reference. I think if you sort of get a flavor for what he's talking about, you can kind of tell with the context, but what he's on about, or if you don't, feel free to ask in class. He is particularly enamored of a couple of the antagonists in Plato's dialogues. There's one named Callicles, who says that morality is basically a conspiracy of the weak to control the strong, and Nietzsche develops this into a full-fledged moral theory. Nietzsche is very similar to Aristotle. He's got a form of virtue ethics and has his own list of virtues. Also, he has a kind of a teleological principle. So teleology, again, it's this idea that has an end or a purpose, that it's a results-oriented philosophy. And so for Nietzsche, it's all about what he calls the will to power, which we'll talk about later. So he's got, like Aristotle, who has, you know, eudaimonia or success, human flourishing as its goal. Nietzsche has the will to power instead. And again, as I mentioned, virtue ethics. So he has a list of virtues, and he takes his virtues, you know, not from the intelligentsia, but from the Vikings. And he has a list of virtues, and interestingly enough, those virtues look to many, you know, modern readers as vices. And the things he lists as vices, people see as virtues. I don't want to go too fast here. We got this teleology, virtue ethics.
These are posted online, right?
Yeah, they'll be posted online too. I'll get this one up right after class. So, just a bit of background. So, we just left off with Aristotle, and I talked about how Aristotle was basically adopted by Christianity as a kind of patron saint of philosophy. And if you read Thomas Aquinas, who's sort of the height of medieval philosophy, the most well-known and greatest of the medieval philosophers, he refers to Aristotle simply as the philosopher. So I'll say, some people will say blah, 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 and they list a bunch of like thorny theological or philosophical problems. And then he says, but the philosopher says blah, blah, and he'll just be quoting Aristotle. And sometimes he'll quote the Bible too. And typically, in his question and answer fashion, he'll pose a bunch of skeptical questions. Well, first he'll state the question, he'll post a bunch of objections, and then there'll be all his replies. And all his replies will be Aristotle and the Bible, quoting one or the other. So the philosopher, patron saint of philosophy. And so you run into this interesting thing where you look at the things which Aristotle would have considered to be virtues are a little different from those in Christianity. So, and I've talked about this before when we were talking about Aristotle. Humility in Christianity is a virtue. Realizing your place in the world, that you are subordinate to God. And I gave you that quote from the book of James where it says, instead of saying, you know, tomorrow we're going to go to such and such a place and do business. So you think about some people, you're planning a business trip. And you say, okay, well, tomorrow we're going flying down to Frisco. We're going to close this deal. And he says, instead you'd say, if the Lord wills it, you know, Lord willing, we'll go down to San Francisco and Lord willing, we'll close this deal. And the idea is you need to keep in mind that everything you do is contingent on the good pleasure of God and God's will. Poverty is seen as a virtue. Jesus says, blessed are the poor. Jesus says it's easier for a rich man to enter heaven than for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. He has blessings for the poor and woes to the rich in his Sermon on the Plain in the Gospel of Luke. And then religious faith is considered to be a virtue. And intellectual activity, you know, runs the gamut from seen as another way of knowing in someone like Aquinas to being somewhat suspect. And so it really depends on which, you know, philosopher you're looking at and what their view on faith and reason is. Yeah.
So are these Aristotle's virtues or
Nietzsche's? So this is talking about Christian virtues. So these are neither Nietzsche's nor Aristotle's.
So these are what Nietzsche would call vices.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, sorry. So this is... and maybe I shouldn't have virtue ethics. This is still sort of thinking about, I think this slide is from the Aristotle presentation, but it's so what I'm talking about now is that after Christianity adopted Aristotle as a patron saint, and people are talking about what are the ideal characteristics of the perfect man and the perfect individual, here's the list they came up with. To be a good man is to be a good Christian. To be a good Christian means you're humble, you're poor, and you have faith. And that you're not too prideful, you don't have a lot of money and power, and you're not like a person who's always thinking about stuff. And as I said, that the attitude towards intellectuals is, you know, you get different attitudes from different people. Like Thomas Aquinas says that reason is perfectly legitimate, and that you can know some of the truths of faith through reason, but there's some things that you can only know through faith. And so he has a pretty pro-intellectual viewpoint. If you look at some other medieval philosophers, they're much more guarded. I think it's Tertullian, one of the early church fathers, asked the question, what does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? Or maybe it was the other way around. What does Jerusalem have to do with Athens? And the idea is Jerusalem is the city of faith. It's the city of you know, Christianity. And Athens is the city of the godless philosophers, right, the pagan philosophers. And he was very against kind of mixing Christianity and pagan philosophy. Now, the view that sort of won out is people like St. Augustine, who studied pagan philosophy and kind of incorporated it into their theology. As, you know, an intellectual, they would say, I'm a Christian, but I'm also an intellectual. And they would bring in a lot of material from Aristotle and other philosophers in developing their theological views. And all throughout the Middle Ages, You had philosophers who would take pagan or classical Greek philosophy, and you know also some Roman philosophy, and they would mix it in with Christianity, and that would be what would be philosophy and theology, would be stuff from the Bible, but interpreted through this classical lens, through the lens of Greco-Roman philosophy. Also, this idea of unconditional love is important in Christianity. Jesus said, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. If someone slaps you on one cheek, offer him the other. If someone asks you to go 1 mile with him, go two. And that has to do with a Roman soldier who could conscript you to carry his pack for a mile. And Jesus said, go that mile and then offer to go another mile, even though it's beyond the call of duty. It's beyond what you're legally required to do. If someone steals your coat, offer them the shirt off your back. Jesus on the cross said, forgive them, Father, they know not what they do, of the people who are actually killing him. And then there's this tendency you see to asceticism and celibacy versus moderation. And I mean, there's a question about how much asceticism is denying your bodily needs and wants for spiritual purposes. A-S-C-E-T-I-C-I-S-M. This would be great for like a spelling bee. I always have problems with this word. Asceticism. But it's the idea of denying your bodily wants and needs for spiritual purpose. And you see this in all different religions, in Hinduism. You see like the guys that lay down on the beds of nails and like roll on their side miles and miles and up steps. People that sit out in the cold and the snow wearing only a loincloth. And fasting is a good example of this. And you see fasting in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the Western religions, where people will go for long periods without eating. And the idea is you take your mind off your body and its wants and needs, and you focus on the world of the spirit, on God, on spiritual things. And in Aristotle, the virtue is moderation. And moderation means just the right amount of eating and drinking. Enjoy your wine, but don't be a drunkard. Enjoy your food, but don't be a glutton. Whereas in Christianity, and more so, I think, you know, in the Middle Ages and not in the Bible, you get some sort of ideas about asceticism, like, you know, Jesus was celibate. Jesus says, blessed are those who become eunuchs for the kingdom of God, meaning a eunuch is a person that has been castrated. and so Jesus doesn't mean this literally, but he's talking about a person who forgoes having a normal marital life, you know, with a wife and kids, in order to pursue ministry, in order to accomplish God's purpose. But you get later on, you have in Christianity, you have people who would like flog themselves with a whip until their backs were bloody to show they're sorry for their sins. You had people that would sit up on pillars, like these rock pillars out in the middle of the desert, and go for days on end without food and water. And even Martin Luther, you know, practiced some of these things where he was going up the steps of some chapel, you know, on bare knees, climbing up step by step, and his knees were bloody, and it just as a sign of penance for his sins, when he had his revelation that that he's justified by his faith and he didn't need to punish himself in order to be sorry for his sins, that Jesus paid for them. But all throughout the Middle Ages, you know, going up until Martin Luther, which is at the time of the Renaissance, when the Middle Ages ended, you have this tendency towards, you know, denying the bodily wants and needs. In the classical world, it's sort of anything goes. It's kind of like the 60s, right? People, you know, having sex with the same gender, opposite gender, in groups, alone, right? It's, you know, whatever floats your boat. And so a sort of a licentious culture. Whereas, as Christianity offers a much more, what you might say, puritanical culture. Although I think if you look at the New Testament, it's it's not all sort of the killjoy stuff. That the idea is that sex has its place within a long-term monogamous relationship, and that's pretty much it. A heterosexual monogamous relationship. But again, in the Middle Ages, you have this sort of emphasis on asceticism. And Nietzsche, a lot of what he reacts to, some of it is stuff in the Bible, but some of it is in, you might say, Christendom, or you know, the institutional versions of Christianity, which focused on you're a dirty, rotten sinner, your body is evil and disgusting, sex is only for procreation, and so on. And then courage. Well, courage, instead of fighting in war, which is the Aristotelian version, is you know literal, that courage fighting with a sword, or with a bow and arrow, or with a spear. Or in Christianity, it's you know, fighting against temptation, fighting the devil, and so on. So this is the view, you know, up through the Renaissance. And in the Renaissance, you get people kind of rediscovering these classical virtues and going back more to the Aristotelian version of what makes a good person. So these are all, again, this is a contrast between Christianity and its virtues, as seen from the first century through the Middle Ages. And then when the Renaissance comes along, it's going back to the classical view. People start thinking more about the human body. They're like painting pictures of naked people and Greek gods, and they found all these old manuscripts of Aristotle and Plato. They're rediscovering philosophy and classical learning. So Nietzsche comes on the scene, and so we talked about God is dead, and actually let's talk about the parable of the madman here. You have any acting majors? Somebody want to try to give a dramatic interpretation? I can do my best. If somebody wants to lend me my book, anybody want to ham it up and do an impression of Nietzsche? Okay, I'll do it. Can I borrow somebody's book for a moment? I gave mine away to somebody that lost theirs.
Hang on to it. The page is big.
Thank you. Body merchandise. Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours and ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, "I see God! I see God!" As many of those who did not believe in God were standing around just then, he provoked much laughter. "Has he got lost?" asked one. "Did he lose his way like a child?" asked another. "Or is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a long voyage? Emigrated?" And thus they yelled and laughed. The madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his eyes. You see, Nietzsche's really into like the eye-piercing thing. He's on his face. And he said, "I will tell you, whither is God? I will tell you, we have killed him, you and I. All of us are murderers. But how did we do this? How could we drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained this earth from the sun? Whither is it moving? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there still any up and down? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? Do we as yet smell nothing of the divine decomposition? God's too decomposed. God is dead. God remains dead. And we have killed him." And then go down a little bit.
Sounds like an H.P. Lovecraft story.
Is not the greatness of this deed too great for us? Must we ourselves not become gods to appear worthy of it? There has never been a greater deed, and whoever is born after us, for the sake of this deed, he will belong to a higher history than all history hitherto. Here the madman fell silent and looked at his listeners. They too were silent and stared at him in astonishment. At last he threw his lantern to the ground and broke it to pieces and went out. "I have come too early." My time is not yet, he said. This tremendous event is still on its way, still wandering. It has yet not reached the ears of men. Lightning and thunder require time. The light of the stars requires time. Deeds, though done, still require time to be seen and heard. This deed is still more distant than the most distant stars, and yet they have done it themselves. So, let's stop there. So that's sort of, you get the idea of Nietzsche's sort of romantic style, his pathos. And so what's this parable supposed to mean? What's it all about? Like, what's Nietzsche's point?
That not everybody has come to that realization yet. And even though he announced it, he announced it before everybody was ready to hear it.
Therefore, he's back.
Yeah. So who does a madman represent in this parable? Does he stand for anybody in particular?
Do you think he's trying to represent himself as the madman? Saying things before their time?
Yeah, it seems like Nietzsche is saying, you know, basically people see him as a madman because
he goes against popular belief.
He's proclaiming the death of God and people aren't ready to hear it yet. And so even though God is dead, people don't realize it. So in what sense does Nietzsche think that's true? Like, in what sense would the people who are like, again, these sort of, think about like intellectuals, college professors, you know, the sort of intelligentsia, in what sense don't they realize God is dead? I mean, they say, oh, I don't believe in that silly superstition anymore. But what do they do that makes it look like they still haven't really shook it off yet?
They still go to church,
don't they? Maybe some of them do, yeah. Maybe they go to church. But I think Nietzsche would say, if you go up to one of these people and you say, well, you know, what are your values? What would they say? Like, what values do you live by? What do you think that your average person living at the time would say?
Still traditionally Christian values.
Yeah, so they wouldn't say they're a Christian, right? But if they're asked, I mean, even Bertrand Russell, probably. He might be like the most famous philosopher of the 20th century, apart from maybe some gloomy existentialist or something. One of the greatest philosophers of the 20th century. And there was an interview he did where the commentator said, you know, well, you know, Lord Russell, he was made a lord. He was knighted by the Queen. And said, Lord Russell, you're known as a great atheist. And he interrupted and said, well, no, I'm an agnostic. And so that's... And then they got back on track, and he said, okay, well, you know, if you suppose you're wrong, suppose you wake up in the presence of God, you know, what would you say? And he'd say, well, I think I would say that I think his first answer was, not enough evidence, God, not enough evidence. But he thought about this a moment more and said, you know, I think I would say that I tried to love my neighbor as myself. And, you know, take care of the poor and the disenfranchised and so on. And if you look at Bertrand Russell's life, he was this big socialist guy. He gave away a lot of money to the poor. He, you know, was always stumping for some cause. And you know, living a life of self-sacrifice and servitude towards humanity, which are basically Christian values, even though he wrote this book, Why I'm Not a Christian. Yeah.
I think Nietzsche's point is that the professors haven't shaken up the notion that there really is right and wrong in some things, and that there's a way to evaluate that outside of themselves. That there's some moral imperative that makes something intrinsically right or intrinsically wrong.
Yeah, they still believe in a kind of absolute right and wrong. And it's questionable whether Nietzsche does or not. I think.
No, I'm saying, I think he, yeah. You asked how might he think that the professors still hang on to
Right, but I think, I mean, when it comes to Nietzsche, there's a debate as to whether Nietzsche's just sort of thinks that there isn't a such thing as absolute value, or whether he has a different interpretation of absolute value. And so I think with the professors and the intellectuals and the intelligentsia, his view is that they're still holding on to morality, and specifically Christian morality. Because, I mean, Nietzsche recognizes there's the classical morality, which is the kind of morality which centers around self-interest and all these certain kinds of virtues that you would need to be sort of an upper-class philosopher, like the Aristotelian virtues. To be a good Greek citizen, you needed certain virtues, and they focused on the individual, whereas Nietzsche thought that when Christianity came on the scene, everything went to hell, so to speak, that Christianity came in and corrupted the values of the Roman Empire and got people to embrace ideas like all men are equal, that you should love your neighbor as yourself, that you should love your enemies, that you should be humble. And he thought that those basically were the decay which tore apart the Roman Empire and led us into the Dark Ages. It's this idea of man as the servile animal, soft and weak. And he a couple of things, he refers to Christians, and again, don't shoot the messenger, but he called Christians like a race of dog men, right? Well, what does he mean by that? Well, you think, what if someone said Christians are a race of dog men, what might they mean?
Pack animals.
Yeah, pack animals who will hold together. You think about it like a dog. What does a dog want to do? Yeah, he wants to please. He's subservient. He wants to please you, right? He's sitting there looking up at you with those adoring eyes, saying, "Oh, you're so great. I just want to do anything you say. If you give me a treat and pat me on the head, I'll just be you know, the happiest creature in the world." And the idea, and so Nietzsche's view is that Christianity makes people servile, dumb, and weak. I suppose it's sort of like, you know, Marx's view of religion as the opiate of the masses, right? That religion is sort of like a drug that's used to kind of keep people down. Now, Marx's view is more political. I think Nietzsche just is trying to say that Christianity has this effect on people. It makes people soft and weak. He also calls it a religion of castrationism. And so the idea there is that it makes people sort of soft and weak. It takes, you know, the kind of the virile masculinity and the drive to live out of people and makes them soft and servile. So what he says is what we need is new values to replace these Christian values. And so again, going back to Aristotle, he says, where did we go wrong? Well, we should have stuck with these Aristotelian virtues and not, mixed him with these Christian ideas. So the basic idea that Nietzsche has is one of the phrases he uses is a reevaluation of all values. And so he thinks we need to take these values that we get from Christianity, and now that we've like junked the Christian metaphysics, we don't believe in the big man in the sky, that there's a reason for everything, that that we don't believe that God loves us and cares for us, and that we have that this life is just training for the next life, and so on. We realize this is all there is. We're not we don't have souls. We're just animals, but we're reasoning animals, like Aristotle said. What's the best set of values which will help us live our lives in a meaningful and fulfilling way? And he says it's not the Christian set. The Christian set is sort of this idea that you spend yourself life sacrificing and you expect heavenly reward. Well, the joke's on you because there is no heavenly reward. There's oblivion. And so you live your life in misery and guilt and self-sacrifice, and then you die, and then you don't get your reward that you were working for the whole time. Nietzsche also talks about this idea of the will to power, within every living thing is this will to live, and it can be kind of sublimated, it can be pushed down by culture or by society or by indoctrination of various kinds. And I think that's what he thinks goes on with the religion. But he says still there's that will to live, that will to power. And that's really what the meaning of life is all about. It's about being a living thing and living your life in a way which sort of actualizes your potential for the kind of thing you are. And this, I think the will to power is very similar to Aristotle's idea of eudaimonia, this idea of being a successful type of the thing that you are.
Didn't he see that sort of a thing is what it is?
I think it's a little different than that. It's this idea of this sort of impressing your will on the rest of the world. It's the idea of volition, of the idea of doing something instead of being a passive participant. You are pushing against the world. You're trying to make your mark in the world. You're trying to bend the world to your will, the way you think it should be.
So it's got domination of some kind.
Yeah, dominate your environment and everything around you, to exploit your environment to your own purpose. So think about like an oak tree, right? So an oak tree, what does the oak tree want to do? It's trying to grow as big as possible. It's trying to put its branches up to the sky. It's trying to get its roots down as deep as possible. Does it pity the grass growing around its base is all going to die because it's sucking all the water out of the soil? No, it doesn't give a damn about the grass. It just wants to suck up as much water and nutrients as possible. And it wants to make itself as big as possible. And then what does it want to do? Drop a bunch of acorns to make more of itself. And that's the kind of picture that Nietzsche has of each individual. It's the idea of growing stronger, of dominating the world and your environment, of feeling the vitality within you, of feeling the strength within you, and going out and doing those things that you're able to do, that you were, I suppose you might say, meant to do, actualizing all of your innate potentials. And this idea of power and imposing your will on the world, Nietzsche sees as what makes life worth living. And this isn't necessarily like being like a political thug, like seizing political power and ordering people about. He thinks it's like you look at a scientist. What does a scientist do? A scientist wants to understand the fundamental principles of nature and then figure out how to manipulate them. He wants to figure out, like say, the way light works and make a laser. He wants to figure out how pressure and temperature works and create a steam engine. He wants to understand all the fundamental forces of nature so he can manipulate and change the world to make his environment better. So he can have, a car and air conditioning and, and an iPod and all this stuff, right? That it comes through people trying to improve on nature. Nietzsche calls himself the world's greatest immoralist. So at the time, a person who did moral philosophy was called a moralist. And moralist didn't have the negative connotation it has today. A moralist there would be just like a person who would speak about virtue. So you think about like somebody like Tony Robbins or I'm trying to think of some other success guru. What's that? Zig Ziglar, right? Yeah. So it's a moralist would just be a person like Dale Carnegie, too, that would just kind of tell you how to live a successful life and how to be a good person. Well, Nietzsche said, well, I'm not a moralist, I'm an immoralist. And this is kind of his joke because he says he's the world's greatest immoralist in that he doesn't really think he's being immoral. What he thinks is that people's values are so screwed up that when he speaks, people think that he's immoral when he's actually the most moral man in the world. Because their value system is upside down, they see him as being evil and corrupt, when actually he's the epitome of morality. But because they have this screwed up version of morality in their heads, they see him as an immoralist. So it's this kind of ironic way of it, of his embracing the fact that everybody thinks that he's this terrible person. He's like, well, I'm the world's greatest immoralist. Because he recognizes that people are going to react to what he has to say in a pretty strong fashion. So what he means by this, just that he's turning values on its head. You know, he's saying that what's up is down and what's left is right. You know, that the whole idea of overturning the present order and replacing it with something which is radically different. And he talks a lot about conventional morality. So when Nietzsche's talking about morality, sometimes he's talking about what most people think of as being moral. When you think about like morality, when you think about what makes a person a moral person, what does that mean?
Someone with integrity.
Okay, integrity, so they're not a hypocrite, they're honest. And Nietzsche actually likes integrity as a virtue, so he might not quibble with that one. Well, what else?
Courage.
Is that really, like, if you say, oh, that person's really moral, do you really think courageous? I mean, that seems, maybe, but I mean, that's not the first thing that pops into my mind. What about, like, they don't hurt anybody, right? It's like, that's usually the first thing. It's like, what makes you a good person? Well, I didn't kill anybody. I don't steal other people's stuff. I respect other people's rights. I mean, you think about, like, the basic morality. It's like, oh, you don't hurt anybody. And then you sort of add things like, oh, well, you know, you give a lot of money away to charity, right? Who's the most demonized segment in this society?
People with money,
exactly. The rich people, the evil rich. I've been going back and forth on the Facebook with this guy, and it's like he's just like being eaten up by greed and envy. Well, not he doesn't see it as greed, but he thinks of all rich people as sort of being evil and selfish because they're hoarding the wealth which is rightfully his, and he's living in poverty. It's not his fault that he's poor. And rich people trick people into buying things they don't need, and they just hoard money under their mattress, and they pay people as little as possible for the job instead of paying them a living wage. And it's just evil, evil rich people. And the idea that if you, you know, are successful and if you make something of value, it seems being somewhat suspicious. And a lot of people would say that like if you compare like the CEO of a Fortune 500 company and you compare that with like somebody that spends their days you know, helping out the animal shelter and I don't know, like recycling and I think about the other things that people think are virtuous, you know, trying to giving speeches to nonprofit groups about the sustainable vegan lifestyle, right? That person is seen as a height of virtue, but the bastard CEO or the scientist or the businessman, they're seen as being like evil and bad. And this is, I think Nietzsche would say that. And then the other thing, and maybe this isn't so much true today, but would have been true in Nietzsche's time, like a moral person is a person who's not selfish. And also it's a person who doesn't go around like having a lot of sex with different people, right? And so it's a person that's kind of, you know, not promiscuous and doesn't go out and get drunk all the time and is sort of serious about their life and doesn't enjoy it too much and spends a lot of time helping other people. And I think still, I mean, would you say that's true today? That I mean, you think about a person is moral in proportion that they spend time trying to help others and not spending time on their own selfish needs and desires. So you think about like, some example on campus here. Well, like you go to like an Osberg meeting, right? And you're like, okay, well, what are we all about? Well, it's like helping the homeless, cleaning up the environment, going down and picking up trash at the river that other people thoughtlessly tossed aside there. I'm trying to think of some other, the sort of social projects, helping out people who are poor and disenfranchised. And Nietzsche thinks that, again, conventional morality tells you, you take a back seat. What you should be doing is helping out as many people as possible and not thinking about your own selfish interests. If you have money, you should give it away. If you have time, you should donate it to some cause. And that sort of idea. And Nietzsche says, if you think about that, and you should kind of feel guilty if you're enjoying yourself, if there's other people in need. And Nietzsche says, if you look at like nature, does the lion pity the gazelle as he's ripping out its entrails and eating it raw while it's kicking and trying to get away? No, it just it does what it does, and it's enjoying its meal, and then it'll go lay down under a tree and take a nap. It doesn't pity the gazelle at all. If you look at the animal kingdom, they enjoy their food, they enjoy having sex, they don't feel guilty about it. They live their life according to the talents and abilities they have, and they don't spend all their time trying to help other animals get along. And Nietzsche thinks we could take a lesson from nature, and that morality really makes us act in an unnatural way. Instead of acting for our own happiness and enjoyment, we spend our time making ourselves miserable, apologizing for any happiness we have to a non-existent big man in the sky who we think is going to send us to a fiery pit if we don't grovel enough. And he thinks that in that way it's kind of a cosmic joke, in that we have all these false beliefs about this other world and it makes our natural lives miserable. Again, don't shoot the messenger. We're trying to give you, where is Nietzsche coming from? So he writes this book called The Genealogy of Morals, and he talks about two systems of morality that grew up side by side, that of the masters and that of the slaves. So he says, you think about if you're the ruler and the ruled, you're going to get different systems of value. And a value is just what people go by when they do things, what their general rule of action is. So values, in the way Nietzsche uses them, aren't some sort of disembodied Platonic ideas floating out there. They're the guidepost that you live your life by. So he says the masters, talking about the rulers, nobility, people with power and money and who are in charge of things. By slaves he means the peasants, the subjects, or sometimes literally slaves, like people who actually were slaves. And so he says, if you think about what kind of value system would emerge from these two classes of people, you can kind of see a pattern of the things which would be useful to each of these groups. And so he lays out two lists of virtues, virtues for slaves and virtues for masters. Can't get too fast here. Need to fit more on my slides here. Look at all that blank space at the bottom. I think I used to do this in the classroom where I only had the bottom, I was missing the bottom third of the screen because there's lecterns and stuff and the screen was down too low. Okay. So master morality. So what do you need to be a master? You got to be physically strong, right? You have to have, battle prowess. You have to be good at war. You have to be physically strong and vital. You can't be laying on your sick bed and walking around with a limp. You're going to get bumped off. You're going to look weak. You're not going to project the right image to your subjects. So you got to be strong and vital. And you have to have the power to go out there and project your power. People have to believe that you're in charge, right? You have to stand up straight, look at the audience and, give like a Hitlerian type speech. And you want people to look up at you with awe. And unless you have that strength and vitality, you can't project it to others and show that you're a person to be feared and respected. You have to have ambition. If you just do as little to get by, if you don't really care about getting ahead in life, you're going to get crushed by the competition. So ambition is a virtue of master morality. Self-control. If you have, if you have a weakness for alcohol, you're going to become a drunkard. You're not going to be a very good leader. You're going to be incompetent. Somebody's probably going to bump you off. If you have a weakness for food, you're going to be balloon up big as a house. People aren't going to respect you. You're going to be weak and soft. And you're not going to project the right image. Also, when you're trying to figure out what you should do militarily, you're like fighting a war. You don't want to be like Hitler and go into USSR because you want to start another war because you're tired of having to kowtow to Stalin and make a foolish decision. You have to bide your time and attack and betray your ally at the right time, after you've crushed Europe, not before. And so you want to have control over your impulses. Intelligence. You got to be a smart guy in order to stay in power. You can't be an idiot. Here's one that might not seem obvious, and he says this is optimism and joy. In order to be a kind of a mover and a shaker in society, he thinks you got to wake up in the morning and you have to think it's a great day to be alive. And it's because if you're kind of like a morose, mopey type person, are you going to have ambition? Are you going to have vitality? Probably not, right? You're going to be, kind of moping around. You're really not going to do anything. You're not going to be a man of action if you don't have that drive. That drive comes from really enjoying life to its fullest, being the kind of a type A personality who wants to seize life by the horns. And he actually wrote a book called Joyful Wisdom, horribly translated the gay science by I think in the 50s before gay had the meaning it had now. But it's a better title, a Joyful Wisdom. Damn you, Walter Kaufman. And then honesty is also a virtue. You might think, okay, well, if you're going to be a leader, you have to learn how to lie. Well, his idea is that if you're a true leader, you're going to be powerful enough that you're able to be honest, and not just with other people. You got to be honest with yourself. You have to be honest about your own weaknesses and strength. You have to be honest about your abilities, about your situation, and you can't get ahead by lying to yourself. So these are all the virtues of the masters. Oh, important one, callousness. So for Nietzsche, callousness is a virtue. And I think really, the master's list of virtues is what Nietzsche thinks is being virtuous in itself. But if you're going to be a master, you're going to rule, you can't be crying over every peasant that died. And you can't feel squeamish about meeting out punishment. And you can't worry about all the poor people and all the lepers and all the sick people and the people that can't take care of themselves. Because if you spend all your resources trying to help people that can't help themselves, you're going to end up at the bottom of the heap. And you're going to lose power. And you're not going to be a happy person if you're out there like hanging around with people that just are basically screw-ups, trying to make them less screwed up. It's a waste of time. Okay, so how does this contrast with the slaves? Well, for the slaves, what's a slave virtue? Well, instead of strength, it's weakness. And meekness or even sickliness. Now why is it a virtue to be weak if you're a slave? Well, you're not going to be, maybe you won't have to do as much work, right? And certainly to be meek, right? It's important because if you're like Spartacus, right? And what happened to Spartacus? Spartacus ends up getting crucified. Right? Why? Because he's a rebel. So if you rebel against the masters and you're a slave, you're probably going to get yourself killed. So it's better to kind of keep your head down. And there's certain people that like take orders well, and there's other people that bristle. Those people that bristle, Nietzsche thinks, those are the masters. The reason is they don't take orders because they're natural leaders. But it's the people that can't take orders, the people that take orders easily and are easily commanded. That's good if you're a slave. If you make a comment under your breath, or if you like refuse to do something that the master tells you to do, it's not going to go well for you. complacency acceptance, right? You have to accept your lot in life. You're a slave. You will always be a slave. If you try to escape, you will be tortured or killed. So it's better just to accept your lot in life. If you're a peasant and you try to rebel, you're going to end up, you know, on a pike on the king's fence. Lack of discipline. So you really don't need self-discipline because you're always getting orders. And so it's really what's good for you is to be easily commanded, to be docile. And lack of discipline is good because you don't want to be a self-starter, because then you're going to, like, you know, you'll be doing extra work. So you want to do as little, get by with as little as possible. So lack of discipline is really, I'm not sure that would be considered to be a virtue, but at least discipline isn't, self-discipline or self-control isn't really a virtue amongst the slaves. I have to think about that on my list here. But this is certainly an important part of this. Stupidity, right? You don't be like Frederick Douglass and like teaching yourself how to read, right? That's kind of dangerous. If you're a slave, you know, Frederick Douglass got lucky and he escaped. But if you're a slave and you're like too smart for your own good, chances are you're going to be a threat to the master. He's going to have you bumped off. Gullibility and faith, right? So you need something to get by. Once you get your like your horrible rations of bread and your like little hovel. And what do? What keeps you going? Oh, well, you look forward to the next life where you're going to be a king ruling over all the evildoers, and the evildoers are going to be thrown into a giant torture pit to suffer forever and ever. And so as you rock yourself to sleep in your cold little hovel with your hard crust of bread, you're thinking, someday I'm going to be in heaven with God and everything will be okay. Pessimism. So again, if you get your hopes up, what's going to happen to your hopes if you're a slave, if you're a peasant? They're going to get crushed, so better not get your hopes up. If you don't expect much out of life, you're not going to be disappointed. Again, self-delusion and denial of reality or religion, and Nietzsche would say, you know, but I repeat myself. And again, this idea that if you can fool yourself into thinking that a better life awaits you, and that the more you obey, the better your future life will be, then that's going to help get you through your mere existence here. And finally, compassion or pity. If you're part of a group of defenseless, helpless screw-ups and people are just, you know, basically worthless and can't even tie their own shoes and are used to being ordered about and really can't do anything by themselves, you get to hang together as a group. You strengthen numbers. And so that's what you do. And so compassion is a virtue in that you have to have compassion for your fellow slaves, and your fellow slaves will have compassion for you. So if you are in a bad way, they're going to sort of help you out. You get flogged by the master, thrown in with the rest of the slaves, are going to help, dress your wounds and maybe give you an extra crust of bread while you're recovering. And pity, is the bane of the master, because if you find yourself pitying someone, what happens is you bring yourself down to their level. You're like an aristocrat. You're walking down the street one day and you see some like blind beggar with leprosy laying there in the street, shaking his little tin cup or something like that. All of a sudden you're like, oh, that poor man, what did he do to deserve this? All of a sudden that little, clip in your step is gone and you're feeling sorry. Maybe you start to shed a little tear. The morning was great, but now you're all depressed and you're thinking about this poor guy. And then maybe you take some money that you earned out of the sweat of your labor and you put it in a little tin cup. And maybe you feel a little better, but it kind of ruins your whole day. And Nietzsche thinks it's better just to ignore that guy, pretend like he's a non-entity, and go about creating great works of art or investigating scientific curiosities or, getting on with the business of ruling and not wasting your time with people with problems. So we'll talk more about Nietzsche on Wednesday. So think about his views, and we're going to have a free-ranging discussion about Nietzsche's views on Wednesday.